When I was just a kid, my father was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and it quickly became very severe. He started thinking the FBI was after him, becoming incredibly paranoid, and he even got into legal trouble for abusing 911. From what my mom told me, he started becoming friends with a variety of very sketchy people that included other mentally ill people, drunks, drug addicts, prostitutes, and homeless people. One day, he didn't come home from work. This was before cell phones were popular. When my mom called his job, they said that he had left on time, and everything seemed normal. She called our family members and some of his real friends from before he had gotten sick. Nobody knew anything or had seen him. When he didn't show up at the house by bedtime, my mother called the police and explained to them that my dad left without any of his belongings except for his wallet and his car, and nobody knew where he was. They eventually agreed to file a missing persons report. His car was eventually found abandoned outside of a shopping center 2 weeks later in New Jersey, 200 miles away from our home in Maryland. Since then, there has been no activity on his credit cards. No family or friends have heard from him, and the detective involved with his case suspected foul play. There were no developments in the case until 15 years later. I was attending college 6 hours away from my hometown, living in a rented house off campus with a few of my friends. While I was at class one day, two disheveled-looking middle-aged men knocked on my door, and in a very polite tone, asked for me by my full name, saying that they had to talk to me and that they were friends with my dad. My roommate said they seemed friendly enough at first, and he started asking them normal questions, like who they were, if they wanted to leave a message for me, and how could I get in touch with them when I got back. They gave very dodgy responses, almost as if they were trying to avoid giving away who they really were, and would follow up with more questions about me, like where I currently was, could they get my cell phone number, and was the car in the driveway with the Maryland plates mine. My roommate told me he started to get bad vibes from them, and said that he was calling the police, and slammed the door on them. They immediately fled. My roommate worked with a sketch artist affiliated with the detective on my dad's case. Nobody recognizes who they are, and we never saw or heard from them again. That happened 8 years ago. It has been 23 years total since my father disappeared, and we still have no answers. This is a story from my past. It happened about 32 years ago, in East Texas. My mom and dad divorced when I was 16 years old. My brothers and I lived with my mom. My dad would visit us every once in a while, but not really on a consistent basis. He was a gambler, one of the reasons my parents split up, and tended to not come around when he was broke. But on the rare occasion that he had won big, he would visit and spend money on us, and then disappear again. My dad said he worked as a shuttle driver for a local hotel. He told my brothers and I that the job was just a front, and that he actually worked for organized crime, which he claimed owned the hotel. He said his real job was to drive out to various places in the area to pick up fugitives running from law enforcement and bring them back to the hotel to hide. My dad said that they would eventually move on, but that he didn't know the particulars about that. My dad was always a blowhard, always exaggerating or outright lying. So my brothers and I thought he was completely full of shit and didn't think much about his claims. Until something strange happened, and my dad disappeared. It was 1988. I was 22 years old and a college student still living at home. I worked as a full-time disc jockey at a local radio station from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. My middle brother, who was 19 years old, rented out an apartment with his friend and worked at Dairy Queen. My youngest brother was only 9 and obviously still lived at home with my mom. One day, my 19-year-old brother called my mom and I and asked us if we knew where my dad was. He said that some men came to the Dairy Queen where he worked and asked him if he had seen his dad recently. He truthfully told them that he hadn't seen or heard from my dad in months, and that this was a regular thing, which was 100% accurate. My brother said these men didn't say who they were, but seemed satisfied, and left. He was wondering if these men or anyone else had called to talk to us and ask us about where Dad was. But the same thing was true for us. We also hadn't heard from him in months. The following day, my brother says the men returned to his work, and this time they had badges, claiming to be FBI agents. He says they were very aggressive and demanded that he tell him where my dad was. My brother kept insisting, truthfully, that he didn't know, and said the last he heard, he was working at a hotel as a shuttle driver. This experience upset him, and he called my mom and I again. My mother became very upset and called the hotel where my dad worked. The man she spoke to said my dad had disappeared weeks ago and had no idea where he was. The following day, my brother was at work when his roommate called and said that somebody had apparently been in their apartment. When his roommate got home, he found that the sliding glass door was open and the place had been ransacked, but that nothing appeared to be missing. Of course, when my brother received the news, he was very upset. He went to the apartment and found, in fact, that a few of his belongings were missing. But before we get into that, I should mention that my brother was a young father at this point in his life. The missing items were an address book, a teddy bear that he had bought for his son, and a photo of his son that he kept in his room. They were sending a message. Now we were all beside ourselves with anger, fear, and paranoia. We went to the local FBI office to complain and tell them once and for all, my brother did not know where my dad was. Well, as you might have guessed, the FBI claimed no knowledge of the event and told us that they were not looking into my father at all and that none of their agents had contacted my brother. Furthermore, when my mother told them that my dad claimed to be working for organized crime, the FBI can neither confirm nor deny that the hotel had ties to the mafia or if there was an ongoing investigation. My mom called the hotel again and told the manager that someone was looking for my dad and that they were terrorizing my brother, and flat out asked the guy if there was any truth to my dad's claim to be working for organized crime. The man laughed at her and said,
"There's no such thing as the mafia."
While we were trying to make sense of all these weird details, we kept wondering why my brother was the only one being harassed and not my mother or me. That's when I was reminded of a strange event that happened to me about 2 or 3 weeks prior. Because I work overnight, I was often wide awake in the middle of the night on my days off, with nothing to do. One night, I went to the local cable TV company where my friend worked as a computer systems operator, just to hang out with him for a few hours and make small talk. It was around 3:30 a.m., he had a big computer repair project that he had to do that night, so it was time for me to head back. As soon as I pulled out from his company's parking lot, a car was immediately behind me, tailgating me. I mean, they were on me so quickly, it scared the crap out of me. The car seemed to just appear out of nowhere. He also had his high beams on, making it hard for me to see. I couldn't make out anything about the vehicle. I couldn't see inside to tell how many people were in the car, what they looked like. Nothing. I changed lanes to let the tailgater pass, but the car stays behind me. I move again, and they move again. They were still tailgating me. I stopped at the intersection and got in the left turning lane with my signal on, and again the car follows behind me. Since there was no other traffic around, the light changed. I zoomed across the intersection into the far right lane, trying to lose them, but they stayed on me. I cut into a nearby neighborhood trying to lose them, but they followed me the whole way, I finally managed to get back out to the intersection. I crossed over and went to the 7-Eleven at the corner. I jumped out and ran inside, yelling at the clerk that there was someone following me and that my life was in danger. As I did, I saw the car that was pursuing me cutting through the parking lot of the gas station, and for the first time I could see the car. I couldn't tell the make or model, but it was a tan-colored four-door car, and there were two men inside. After passing by the storefront, they drove off. The clerk just blew me off and said that I was exaggerating, that it was probably just kids messing around. I eventually left, but I was still freaked out, and I didn't want to go straight home, afraid that they may follow me. And after what just happened, I didn't want them knowing where I lived, so I instead drove to my workplace. I knew that the disc jockey on air that night would be my friend Paula, so I decided to go visit her while she was on air. Perhaps we could make a segment out of it. I told her what happened, and I hung out for about 2 hours. She also felt that it was probably just a prank, and that helped calm me down. It had been over 2 hours since the first incident, and I was now heading back home. As I was coming down the street toward my apartment building, I see that same damn car pulling out of my parking lot. As it passed me, they flashed their high beams on. It had to be them. I panicked and rushed inside and called Paula at the radio station and relayed to her what had just happened.
"Oh my God, they were waiting for you at your apartment? You have to call the police right away."
My mind was racing as to how they could possibly know where I lived, why they would wait there for 2 hours, and then when they finally saw me, they just flashed their lights, and that's it? None of this made any sense to me. Remembering that event, and putting it together with my brother's FBI visit, and the apartment break-in, it seemed obvious it was all tied together. I hadn't thought about it before, but now I remembered. The car that I was driving used to belong to my father. He had given it to me about 2 months before this happened, when he had gotten a new one. So if someone had been looking for my dad, they could have thought that I was him. And when they saw me coming home, they realized that I wasn't him and just left. But who was messing with us? And why? Where the hell was my dad? My mom, my brother, and I went to the police station to file a missing persons report, and we spoke to a very nice detective. About 5 days later, we get a phone call from him. It turns out that my dad disappeared because he owed over $50,000 in gambling debts. The detective did confirm that he did work for some unsavory characters, but they weren't exactly organized crime per se. He had no idea if my dad was shuttling fugitives or not. The detective said that he was likely hiding out somewhere in Nevada and that he had spoken to him over the phone. He was alive and well, but in hiding. We then asked who the hell were these men bothering my brother and I. The detective explained it wasn't uncommon for bounty hunters or debt collectors to impersonate law enforcement and call and harass people. My brother then asked how they managed to get into his apartment. The detective said a sliding glass door was pretty easy to open, and that they probably stole the address book hoping to find my dad. They also took the teddy bear and pictures to scare my brother, which worked. I then asked the detective why the men only harassed my brother, and not my mom and I, except the one time. It was then revealed that my dad had used my brother as a reference on his job application at the hotel and put down my brother's address and phone number as his own. The fake FBI agents probably figured he was close to my dad and maintained contact with him. So my dad eventually turned back up in town and acted like nothing ever happened. He never spoke of this incident, and we never brought it back up. I guess he ended up paying off the money he owed. I don't know the details surrounding that, but yeah, that's my story. This happened a long time ago, Before cell phones were prevalent, I was a mother in my early 30s who had just driven my kids to the pediatrician. The doctor's office was in Macon, Georgia, and was about an hour away, and I was taking the two youngest of my three to our scheduled appointment. At the time, they were ages 1 and 3. Because we lived so far away, their office gave us the last two appointments of the day, and I was grateful for that. The doctor had just built a new facility off the highway, so the location was quite isolated in every direction, but it was a very nice building compared to his old spot by the hospital. His new building was also pretty far back on the new lot. My black Jeep Cherokee was only one of 4 or 5 cars in the lot when we arrived. I parked near the front door, removed the kids from their car seats, and for the next hour or so we waited, then saw the doctor, paid, and we were finally heading back outside. By this point, my Jeep was the only one left in the parking lot. I loaded up the children into the car seats for the long trip home, but as the receptionist locked the front glass doors, my car, for some reason, would not start. Whenever I turned the key, there was just this odd clicking noise. Gathering the children once again, I knocked on the front door until someone allowed us back inside, and I asked to use their phone so I could call a nearby garage for service. I found one in the phone book. Remember those? The attendant I spoke to on the phone said that he would be there, but that it might take a while. I told him my location and left to get back into the Jeep, rolled down the windows, and loaded the kids back into their car seats once more. And we waited. We watched as all the lights were turned out in the building, and everyone left, their cars departing one by one from the employee parking lot behind the building, leaving us completely alone. I spent a lot of the time trying to tend to the children, digging through our car for snacks and a bottle, and making sure they weren't getting too hot. Although the service station attendant said that he was probably going to be a while, I was surprised when I saw a truck pull into the empty lot, and pretty soon, a man stepped out. He smiled and nodded, and said that he was going to raise the hood. He was a middle-aged man, a bit scruffy-looking. But honestly, most of the folks I know who work on cars often look like that, especially at the end of the day. I was just grateful that he was here working on the car. I sat down again in the driver's seat with the door open, waiting for him to tell me to try the engine, but he seemed to be taking a long time checking all the connections. I wanted him to just grab his jumper cables or something, but he never did. Without getting out of the car, I asked him what was wrong. He responded, "Oh, it's just a loose wire. It's not the battery," and continued with whatever he was doing. I couldn't see his face at all from where I was sitting, but his hands were slightly visible through that long horizontal slit between the windshield and the raised hood. More than once, he said that it was just a loose wire. "Can you just come up here real quick and I'll show you which one, so that this never happens again?" I remember kind of smiling and shaking my head, saying that there was no reason to show me anything, as I know nothing about cars. I politely thanked him and stayed in the driver's seat, again just waiting for the inevitable signal to try to start the ignition. Surely that was coming any moment. At one point, I remember thinking that he was definitely flirting with me as he spoke. I was trying above all to be polite and kind, as I thought he was trying to help us, but we were hot and tired and miserable. And truthfully, I was distracted with the kids. He was beginning to sound a bit frustrated with me because I wouldn't get out and look at the engine. I remember thinking that I certainly didn't want to make him mad to where he left us all alone with the sun sinking so quickly. And then, the strangest thing happened. Another truck suddenly pulled into the parking lot, and as it did, the man suddenly slammed the hood shut, ran to his truck, and quickly drove away, without even saying goodbye. I was both confused and a bit anxious when he did this, because I didn't know who was arriving. I remember feeling a bit apprehensive that he had left me there all alone with my two little ones, completely defenseless. Why wouldn't he at least stay, or speak to whoever just pulled up? That certainly seemed like the gentlemanly thing to do. I looked around, and was very aware. Once again, there were no visible cars on the road, no homes or businesses nearby, and the sun was continuing to set. It was near dark. As this new, unmarked pickup truck pulled up next to me, I got out of the car once again. This time I was a bit more apprehensive. Upon exiting, the man immediately introduced himself. His name and voice seemed to match who I had spoken to on the phone earlier. He actually called me by name and apologized for being so late. He then asked me who that man was who had just left. Relieved and unfazed, I just smiled back in surprise and told him, "Well, I don't know. I thought all this time he was you." We both laughed, and he grabbed his jumper cables, walked in front of my car, raised the hood, and began to work. I immediately sat back in the driver's seat once more, suddenly grateful that, with a bit of luck, the air conditioner will be blowing at full blast here shortly. While listening for the man to tell me to try the engine, I had my back completely turned as I was checking on the children. The man surprised me by suddenly coming near the driver's side door. He then said in a very concerned voice, "Ma'am? Is this yours?" When I looked in his hands, he was holding a very long, dagger-like object that was about a foot and a half in length. It appeared to be very old and covered in rust. On one end, it had these tiny circular finger holes, as if it was a mix between a sword and a pair of scissors. I remember being amazed, but not frightened. I asked where he had found it. "It was under your hood." I just said, matter-of-factly, that I had never seen it before. He continued to stand there and stare at it. He looked oddly pale, as if he couldn't find the words to say, and just continued staring at the unusual object. Honestly, all I cared about was getting the Jeep started. Nothing else mattered. He didn't say anything else. He just set it on the curb, started his truck, and then signaled for me to start the Jeep. When the engine eventually started back up, my three-year-old cheered. I quickly turned the AC on at full blast, rolled up all the windows, and aimed the air vents toward the back seat, and reached for my purse to pay. I got out of the car, took a few steps toward him, so that he could tell me what I owed. He came back around to my driver's side. But instead of handing me the bill, he walked right past me, and picked up that strange object again. "Ma'am, I want you to look at these one more time." He held it out for a closer inspection. This time I moved a bit closer, and really looked at it. In his hands, the item still appeared incredibly large, possessing an almost bayonet quality, except for the small loopholes at the end. I had never seen anything like it, and I told him so. As he held it, he spoke quietly, as if desperately trying to make me understand something that was somehow still going over my head. "These were not hidden in your engine, ma'am. They were sitting right on top, meaning that they had just been placed there." I shook my head and smiled. "They're obviously very old and rusty." To which he pointed more closely and replied, "Yeah, but do you see how sharp it is? This blade looks like it has just been sharpened." When I looked down, I could see that he was right. The long dagger-like shape was unusual, but by far the oddest quality was just how sharp it appeared to be. The edges at the tip where the rust had been removed was shining. As I paid him, his final words to me were, "I don't know what was about to happen here, but I'm really glad I pulled up when I did." He quietly thanked me when taking the payment, and told me that I probably needed to contact the police when I got home, and then asked me where I wanted him to place the dagger. I didn't even want to take it with me, but I opened the back window so he could place it in the trunk. We left the lot together, him turning one way and me towards the other, heading down the small winding highway that led home, which was still an hour away. The moment that we arrived home and the children were safely inside, I did in fact contact the police. Although the officer on the phone listened politely, he declined when I offered to bring in the scissor-like sword. I was told that they sounded like they were a pair of specialized surgical shears, based on my description and measurements over the phone, which I found to be quite disturbing. I remember wondering how he would even know that. I tried my best not to touch any of the surfaces, hoping that someday they might be able to lift off prints or test it for DNA. But the story seemed to bore the officer. He didn't really seem interested at all. His attitude insinuated that there was no longer an emergency, and this phone call was no longer important. At the very end of the call, as if to spice things up a bit, he did suggest that it sounded as if I was very lucky, and that I might want to hold on to the shears for a couple of days, just in case someone from his office got back to me later. I wrapped it carefully in newspaper and placed it in a brick storage unit behind our house. There they remained for several years, untouched, until we finally moved out. Not wanting to bring them across several states, I reluctantly threw them in the garbage. If you look through the old news reports, several women had gone missing all over the state of Georgia. Some bodies were eventually found, but others remain missing to this very day. I have often wondered what would have happened if that service attendant hadn't arrived when he did. If my children would still have a mother, if I would still have my son and daughter, if I would have missed all these years with them. I guess I'll never know. But I learned something very important about myself that day. I had always felt that I was pretty aware of my surroundings, pretty good at reading people, and staying safe. But because I was so exhausted and tired and hot and stranded in a different city, my common sense and intelligence simply left me for a while and wasn't working at that time. Many of my friends and family believe that our car trouble and my lack of awareness that day could have easily cost us our lives. In the summer of 2006, two groups of tourists took the now-closed hiking trail at Mount Robson in British Columbia. What resulted was one of the strangest cases of missing persons in the province's history. As the son of one of the hikers who went up that day, I have naturally wanted to find out exactly what happened. Long after the investigation closed, I continued to search for answers. This is what I discovered, based on eyewitness testimony, police records, and meteorological data. The day started off a little chilly for that time of year, but not cold enough to be considered dangerous. The tour guide separated the hikers into two groups, Group A, the fast group, and Group B, the leisurely group, which was a diplomatic way of saying that they were slow. My mother, an avid hiker, was put into Group A. There was supposedly a running gag between the guides that whoever reached the summit last had to wear these embarrassing neon green socks on their next excursion. But to make things fair, would also get to lead the faster group next time. At least that's how they explained the very unfashionable socks worn by the leader of Group A that day. Both groups were estimated to reach the summit by noon, with Group A scheduled to arrive about an hour ahead of Group B. Each group had a pair of walkie-talkies for safety reasons. The hike itself was supposed to be fairly safe, taking the scenic route on multiple occasions to avoid potential danger spots. There was only one way up, and only one way down. Group A quickly took to the trail, while Group B lagged behind. They made it about two-thirds of the way up when my mother slipped on a mossy rock and sprained her ankle. One of the guides got on the walkie-talkie and contacted Group B, who was carrying the first aid kit. At that point, Group B was a little under half an hour behind. Not wanting to ruin their reputation of being the fastest, Group A insisted on going ahead without my mom. They left her by the trail with one of the guides and a spare walkie-talkie, then resumed their hike. The temperature was getting much more comfortable by that point, so the guide and my mom didn't have to take any special measures to stay warm while they waited for Group B to catch up. For the next half hour, everyone stayed in contact using their walkie-talkies, and everything seemed fine. Group B eventually caught up to my mom. As they were tending to her ankle, they called ahead to Group A to check their progress. At that point in time, they had almost reached the summit. Once she was all patched up, my mom could have chosen to turn around and go back down the mountain with her guide. However, she chose to keep going with the slower group. I guess she really wanted to see the summit. This is where things get weird. At approximately 10:55 a.m., a sudden increase in temperature and atmospheric pressure was reported. Based on the meteorological data, there was a spike of approximately 15 degrees Celsius that dissipated by the time the devices conducted their next check. This is just an educated guess, but that means it lasted somewhere between 3 to 5 minutes. Now, to be fair, Environment Canada's meteorological services deem this spike to be a glitch, but many people in the surrounding area did in fact report feeling a sudden, but temporary, wave of heat around the same time. What followed was a low atmospheric rumble that sounded similar to thunder, and that it seemed to vibrate through the sky, but with a softer, less fluctuating tone. There were no storm clouds at the time, and no planes were reported in the area. Despite this, Group B continued up the mountain, with my mom in tow. When they reached the summit, they found themselves alone. They could see Group A's tracks all the way up to the summit, but they ended there. There were no tracks going down, and no signs of anyone going over the edge. There were no signs of them anywhere. It was assumed that their walkie-talkie had run out of battery, and since my mother and the guide had been left with their only spare, they were unable to reply. Investigators assumed that they had gotten lost in the woods and never made it to the summit at all, and that all the tracks that were found were from Group B. Whatever the case, 15 hikers went missing that day and were never found. I often ask my mom to tell me her side of the story, to clue me in on any details I may have missed, or things that hadn't been reported, but she refuses to talk about it. She'll either change the subject or stare off blankly into space until I shut up, which is very abnormal for my mom. There's only been one other thing that's ever solicited that kind of response out of her. The feet. In 2007, human feet, mostly left feet, started washing up on the shores of British Columbia. Nobody knows where they're from or who they belong to. Go ahead and look into it if you want to. It's one of those really bizarre unsolved mysteries you rarely hear about. When my mom heard about them, she became as silent as a grave. You wouldn't think these feet would be related to the story in any way. Mount Robson is on the east side of British Columbia, far inland, bordering Alberta. You wouldn't think there would be any kind of connection. But you also wouldn't think that many people wear high-end hiking boots with bright neon green socks.